This hearing of the Subcommittee on Nutrition entitled The Next Farm Bill, The Future SNAP will come to order. I want to welcome everyone to the today's hearing. Good afternoon. Today's Nutrition Subcommittee hearing on the future of SNAP. This hearing continues the committee's series to review current policy and to set the stage for the next Farm Bill. Thank you to everyone for taking the time to be here, particularly our five witnesses. The House Agriculture and the Committee on Agriculture completed a comprehensive review of SNAP during the 114th Congress, known as the Past, Present, and Future SNAP. And the purpose of the review was to provide a better understanding of SNAP, the population it serves, how the program administers food benefits, and other services to assist that population, and to examine ways the program can be improved. While the series highlighted specific ways that vulnerable populations are well served, it also exposes several areas for improvement. While prior witnesses have touched on the future SNAP in the context of specific hearing topics, this hearing's purpose will be solely to discuss the future. SNAP, formerly called the Food Stamp Program, is designed primarily to increase the food purchasing power of eligible low-income households to help them buy a nutritionally adequate low-cost diet. Benefits vary by household size, income, and expenses like shelter and medical costs, and averaged nearly $126 per person per month in 2016. SNAP is the largest program in the domestic hunger safety net, currently offering nutrition assistance to 42.9 million eligible low-income individuals and families, all the while providing economic benefits to communities. SNAP has seen considerable growth in recent years. The cost of the program more than doubled from $37.6 billion in 2008 to nearly $80 billion at its peak in 2013. Likewise, participation in the program increased from 28.2 million participants in 2008 to 47.6 million participants in 2013. As the economy has recovered from the recession, participation in the cost of SNAP has slowly started to decrease. In 2016, total costs were $70.97 billion, with participation at 44.2 million. Now, this hearing will provide additional opportunity for stakeholders to discuss their priorities for improvements to SNAP in the upcoming Farm Bill in areas such as ensuring adequate nutrition, strengthening the pathway towards self-sufficiency, bettering outcomes for children and families via education, and further advancing program efficiency and integrity. The panel we will hear from this afternoon will offer insight based on their operational and policy experience. Now, these well-informed perspectives are critical as we look towards Farm Bill reauthorization. With a focus on acknowledging what works, reducing administrative burdens, and discussing areas for improvement, our goal is to ensure that SNAP benefits reach those most in need in the most effective and efficient manner possible. I want to thank all of our witnesses for sharing their time and their expertise, and I now recognize the ranking member of the committee, Mr. McGovern, for any opening comments he'd like to make.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always good to be with you, and I want to thank our expert witnesses for being here today. I look forward to your testimony. The title of today's hearing is The Next Farm Bill, The Future of SNAP. If I may, let me offer my colleagues a little constructive advice. First, let me say, don't even think of separating the nutrition title from the Farm Bill. That would be a huge mistake, and if it's done, I guarantee you there'll be no Farm Bill. Second, with regard to SNAP, don't screw around with the program, period. There is no reason whatsoever, based on all of our now 20 hearings, to undermine SNAP through structural changes, block grants, further restrictions, more onerous requirements, or cuts. Please do not do anything that will make hunger worse in our country. As my, I've read some news reports that the ABOB population might be in the committee's crosshairs. That's able-bodied adults without dependents. As my colleagues know, the majority of people on SNAP who can work do work. ABOBs, under current law, are told if they don't have a job or are not in a job training program within a three-month period of time, they're thrown off of SNAP for 3 years. I quite strongly disagree with that approach. And now we're reading that there are some on the committee who don't even want to give a person 3 months. So who are ABODs? Some are veterans trying to reintegrate back into their communities. Some are homeless. Some have undiagnosed mental illnesses. Some live in areas of high unemployment where job training programs are few or filled. Some live in rural areas without transportation, where it is difficult to get a job or to get to a job training program. In short, this is a very complicated population. But as usual, I think there are some who are more interested in a soundbite rather than in the reality. I would just say enough. We should at least do a hearing on the ABOD issue before making the lives of millions of Americans more miserable. So if we're talking about the future of SNAP, we need to focus on how to make the program even better. We need to make sure that anyone who needs modest food assistance benefits has access to them. We need to support and expand innovative programs that help increase the purchasing power of SNAP. And we need to increase SNAP benefits, which currently average a mere $1.40 per person per meal, to provide families who benefit from the program with access to more nutritious food that lasts them through the entire month. Mr. Chairman, I look forward to hearing from our witnesses today. And based on their prepared testimony, I would say that these witnesses will concur with all the other witnesses that we have had before this committee, both brought forward by the majority and the minority, who have said that SNAP is a good program. It is a successful program. It is a program with a low fraud and error rate. It is a program that provides people food assistance, and that it is important that we not undermine it in any way. And that's what I and that's how I hope we proceed. And again, I thank you, and I yield back my time.
Gentleman yields back. The chair would request that other members submit their opening statements for the record so the witnesses may begin their testimony to assure that there's ample time for questions. Please now to welcome our witnesses to the table. Thank you so much for taking the time and everything else that it takes to come here to share your passion, your expertise on this incredibly important topic. And our witnesses include Ms. Stacy Dean, Vice President for Food Assistance Policy, Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C., Mr. Russell Sykes, Director of Center for Employment and Economic Well-Being, American Public Human Services Association, Washington, D.C., Mr. Joe Arthur, Executive Director of Central Pennsylvania Food Bank, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Mr. Josh Protus, Vice President of Public Policy, Mazon, a Jewish Response to Hunger, located based here in Washington, D.C., and Ms. Jennifer Hatcher, Senior Vice President, Government and Public Affairs, the Food Marketing Institute, based in Arlington, Virginia. Ms. Dean, please begin with your 5 minutes of testimony when you're ready.
Thank you, Chairman Thompson, members of the subcommittee and full committee. Thank you very much for the invitation to testify today. I'm Stacy Dean, Vice President for Food Assistance Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan policy institute here in DC. And I'm very pleased to be here with you today to talk about SNAP and to share ideas for the next Farm Bill. I've worked on the program for more than 20 years, and this will be my fifth Farm Bill. SNAP is the nation's most important anti-hunger program. It currently helps about 43 million low-income Americans to afford a nutritionally adequate diet at more than 200,000 retail outlets. Despite its modest benefits, it has powerful short and long-term impacts. And SNAP's success can largely be attributed to its national entitlement structure. It helps families and communities weather tough economic times. It reduces poverty and food insecurity. It improves health, and it supports work. The program has proven to be particularly important to families with very young children, having lasting effects on their health and development. Maintaining and building upon these strengths is the first step towards a successful Title IV. So let me turn now to some ideas for the next Farm Bill. The list I'll run through draws from my written statement and highlights areas for consideration, and they include benefit adequacy, eligibility policy, access to SNAP, program integrity, and employment and training. So first, benefit adequacy. SNAP's maximum benefit per person per meal, based on USDA's Thrifty Food Plan, is about $1.90. while the average benefit is $1.40. Evidence is mounting that the Thrifty Food Plan is insufficient for households to purchase a healthy diet. SNAP's core purpose is to meet low-income households' basic nutritional needs. If its basic benefits cannot achieve that goal, then they really must be reconsidered. Let me move on to eligibility policy. So SNAP is generally available to low-income households regardless of their demographics. There are some additional restrictions, though, which can impede SNAP's ability to help some struggling individuals and families meet their food needs. The ABOD rule, mentioned by Mr. McGovern, is one of them. This group are childless adults working less than 20 hours per week. Despite their very low incomes, this group is only eligible for 3 months of SNAP out of every 36 unless they can maintain a job at 20 hours a week. This harsh time limit is frequently called a work requirement, but states are not actually required to offer these individuals a work slot before terminating their benefits, and most don't. We really encourage the committee to consider easing this tough rule. In the area of SNAP access, it's important to highlight that SNAP is incredibly successful at reaching eligible people. USDA estimates that 83% of eligible individuals participate, one of its true successes. Yet some groups have participation well below this level. For example, only 42% of eligible seniors participate in the program. Many of the same low-income seniors also are eligible for and similarly miss out on Medicare's low-income drug subsidy program and assistance from Medicaid to pay their Medicare premiums. So rather than tackle low senior enrollment issues in SNAP alone, I propose considering low or no-cost ideas that would more effectively package these three benefits together to respond to the needs of low-income seniors more holistically. The Social Security Administration already acts as an application hub for these benefits, and that role could be strengthened. Shifting to program integrity, my written testimony includes several ideas that would enhance program accuracy, such as increasing access to current wage records for states. And while fraud is a minimal problem in SNAP, it's important to keep making improvements in this area. One suggestion is to expand a current pilot FNS is running to check for dual enrollment across states in the Southeast to make that pilot go nationwide. Finally, SNAP's employment and training program is one of the most active areas of discussion and innovation within SNAP today. It's a significant program serving over 1 million people last year. Many states are considering how to shift their programs from punitive, process-oriented approaches to ones focused on longer-term success, which engage participants ready to build up their skills and move up the economic ladder. A new investment in employment and training, perhaps through a competitive grant program, could allow states to expand programs that support individuals who face difficulty finding employment or offer career and technical training that's informed by the local business community. So in conclusion, over the many years that I've worked on SNAP, Congress has truly endeavored to balance the need to maintain SNAP's successful structure and design with changes to the program that respond to the needs of underserved groups, such as working families and seniors, and to test and implement new ideas to improve the program's efficiency without compromising its effectiveness. And as you consider ideas for the new Farm Bill, I urge you to keep those goals your priority. I look forward to the discussion today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dean. Mr. Sykes, go ahead and proceed with your 5 minutes of testimony when you're ready.
Thank you, Chairman Thompson and others, and a particular thank you to my Congressman, John Faso, who I've known and worked with for years. My name is Russ Sykes. I'm the director, as I said, I work at the American Public Human Services Association. We are the appointed, we represent the appointed CEOs of human services agencies nationwide, many local organizations and well, and one of our affiliate organizations is the American Association of SNAP Directors. So we like to think as the practitioners who run the program at the ground level that we have a sort of unique credibility to speak about the pros and cons of the program. I want to make it very clear that the overarching point is that while there's always room for reform, modernization, and improvement, SNAP is perhaps the most pivotal and economically responsive program federally during times of economic hardship to ensure that families and children have healthy lives and economic and social well-being. It both reduces very low food security very clearly and does it well, and it keeps almost 5 million people, including over 2 million children, out of poverty based on 2013 data. It drives benefits disproportionately at hard economic times into distressed communities where unemployment is high and other issues exist. So I want to say that whatever you do in reauthorization, that essential responsiveness of the program needs to be preserved. I want to focus on specific points of work, simplification, flexibility for states, the importance of system integration and shared data, measuring program success in broader terms, discussing honestly the issue that has come before you in the past about purchase restrictions and whether they should or should not occur, and finally, resources and the notion of an income cliff that happens to some that are on the program. Let me start with talking about work. We are strong proponents of work, but we're strong proponents of work programs that actually try to find people jobs, try to help them stay in those jobs, and provide the short-term training needed based on what actually is available in local communities. We think that employers need to play a significant role in developing that kind of curricula, as do community colleges, and it needs to be short-term. And we believe that work, obviously, is the economic pathway out of poverty. So turning to ABODs, as Ms. Dean mentioned, I just want to simply say we're strongly in favor of work rules for able-bodied adults, but I think, the ranking member McGovern pointed out, it's a very complicated population. And I think when we come right down to enforcing those rules, we have to make sure that we provide real opportunity and don't use the enforcement of those rules simply as a sanction policy, or we lose some of the people that we very most need to be helping. On simplification, I've seen this program over my 42 years working on it, dating myself, go from something that was fairly simple in many ways to a very complex program from the eligibility and verification per standpoint. And so we really would like to see the program focused more on outcomes and simplified a bit for states. And we also believe in state flexibility. I know in your previous hearings that you discussed how many waivers and options states do have at their wherewithal already. But there is more that can be done in that front, and we strongly urge that we think of those areas because states are closest to the ground. They understand their clients, they understand their labor markets, and they understand how important the program is in economic hard times. System integration with Medicaid and multiple other programs is absolutely critical. Tiny steps have been taken in that direction with the Federal Data Hub and other areas, but much more needs to be done. And shared data is really critical. We need to do more in regard to building common databases so people aren't re-enrolling in every different program repeatedly without having some sort of common identifier to help them be in programs. We have several new pilots that we'd like to think that you should explore. One, as Ms. Dean also mentioned, is whether benefits are adequate. I think we really don't know, although there is increasing evidence that they may not be. But what I would suggest is that we ought to run a geographically diverse pilot that tests the thrifty food plan versus the low-cost food plan and rigorously evaluate it to see whether it makes a difference in very low food security or not. Similarly, we ought to do the same thing with the earned income disregard. While we talk about needing to get those who do not work to work, we have many people on the program who are already working, and it's a critical income support for them, and they are able to deduct 20% of their earnings. We would like to see that raised to 30%. We'd like to see broader measurements of the program than simply quality control and error rates. Those are incredibly important from an integrity point of view. But there are other things about poverty, very low food security reduction, access of job placement. On purchase restrictions, I would close with this. We also don't know, although we can see the public health division with the anti-hunger community division around, whether sugar-sweetened beverages in particular lead to difficult health outcomes in the areas of obesity and diabetes. Again, a pilot program that would look to test whether that kind of a prohibition would result in simple substitution patterns of someone's own money, or whether it really would reduce the incidence of those kind of diseases would be something very important. I look forward to continuing dialogue with you. All of these comments have been amplified in my my written remarks, and look forward to talking further and look forward to the discussion today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sykes. Now I yield to my colleague from Pennsylvania for the purpose of introducing our witness from Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and to the ranking members and members of the committee, Joe Offa is someone who I know extremely well. In my days in the legislature, I was a part of something called the Hunger Task Force. And working with Joe and others, we did something called the Hunger Garden. But I want to make it very clear that the Hunger Garden will not replace the aspect that you do need SNAP too, so you need both. Joe was appointed executive director of the Central Food Bank in July 2011. After serving as the associate director from 2008, Joe has served as a volunteer board member with the food bank. As the food bank principal ambassador, Joe presented regularly on issues of hunger in Pennsylvania to community groups, legislative gatherings, government partners, prospective donor organizations, and other forums. Joe is a leader in the anti-hunger work through his engagement as a board member for the association Feeding Pennsylvania. Hunger Free Pennsylvania, Hunger Free Lancaster County, as a national conference represented the food bank national affiliation. Joe will tell you that's where I learned the difference between soil and dirt, making that distinction. Prior to joining the food bank in 2008, Joe worked 23 years in financing and accounting, primarily with Pennsylvania community banks. Joe holds a BS in accounting from Penn State and is a member of the Pennsylvania Institution of Certified Accountants. And more than Joe, I thank you for your leadership. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, gentlemen. Now please recognize Mr. Arthur for 5 minutes of testimony.
Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member McGovern, and distinguished members of the House Agriculture Subcommittee on Nutrition, and of course my friend from Philadelphia, Representative Evans, thank you for inviting me to testify on the importance of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and the program's direction in the next Farm Bill. You've heard my introduction. The part you didn't hear is that we distributed about 48 million pounds of food and grocery products in our 27-county service territory last year. And we worked with over 900 community organizations that are our member agencies in that work. And these agencies directly feed thousands of hungry families throughout central Pennsylvania. The 27 counties within our service territory in central Pennsylvania represent the most rural of the Commonwealth. While we have more than 1.8 million people in our state who struggle with hunger, we are blessed with more than 57,000 family farms, 30,000 of which are in our service territory. In a region as agriculturally rich as central Pennsylvania, there is no reason that anybody should go to bed hungry. And we are proud of our partnerships with agriculture. With respect to Pennsylvania's extensive dairy industry, we are proud to share that our food bank operates the third largest charitable milk program in the nation, distributing over 1,600 quarts of fresh refrigerated milk every business day. And that we built this program in less than 3 years with the help of our Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, various dairy industry experts and promotional firms, and of course, dairy farmers and processors. We are much more than a provider of food assistance, as Chairman Thompson can attest from his many personal visits over the years. We operate out of two healthy food hubs, separated by two driving hours along the beautiful Susquehanna River. We have equipped those with state-of-the-art warehousing and cold chain infrastructure, efficient loading docks to handle our 16 refrigerated trucks, and commercial quality demonstration kitchens to teach healthy eating, cooking, and healthy shopping habits. While our food bank works tirelessly to provide emergency food assistance to families at risk of hunger, the problem is too big to fix without our taxpayer-funded safety net programs such as SNAP. While we do make a big difference for people in our community, national programs reach far more people. And if that system should be cut or eliminated or seriously cut, we would not be able to backfill the increased demand that would occur from those actions. SNAP is the backbone of the National Nutrition Safety Net, the first line of defense against hunger, and it helps nearly 1.8 million people in Pennsylvania, or about 14.2%. And it helps them buy groceries every month and lifts about 13% of those households out of poverty. As the House Agriculture Committee works on a new farm bill, we urge you to consider five key points. SNAP supports agriculture, local economies, jobs, and retailers. On the agriculture front, Pennsylvania's leading economic enterprise, agriculture, benefits strongly from the SNAP program. For example, the largest farm commodity in Pennsylvania is dairy. About 9% of spending by SNAP households is actually on dairy. Local economies. Economic research indicates that every SNAP dollar redeemed expands the economy by roughly about $1.70, leading to billions in local economic activity. Billions with a B. In fact, roughly $2.6 billion in SNAP dollars issued in Pennsylvania in fiscal year 2015 generated about $4.6 billion of economic activity. The economic benefits spread through the entire food supply chain, benefiting grocers, retailers, manufacturers, producers, and farmers, and supporting millions of jobs. Number two, SNAP is timely and it responds to changes in need. One of the strongest features of SNAP is its ability to respond quickly. We've seen it grow since the recession, and now we've also seen it in recent periods actually reducing. And in fact, it contributed more than $30 billion in savings over the course of the last Farm Bill and contributed to more than $90 billion in savings overall. It's a program that works, and it works on the downside, too. Number three, SNAP is temporary and encourages work, and we've heard a great deal about that already. Number four, SNAP provides states flexibility and federal accountability. And number five, SNAP is efficient and accurate. So as the subcommittee works on a new Farm Bill, we look forward to working with you to demonstrate how strong support for nutrition programs and agriculture programs can strengthen communities such as the one that we serve in central Pennsylvania. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify.
Mr. Arthur, thank you so much for your testimony. Mr. Prose, please go ahead with your 5-minute testimony whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chairman Thompson, Ranking Member McGovern, distinguished members of the Subcommittee on Nutrition and the Committee of Agriculture. Thanks so much for the opportunity to testify here today. I'm pleased to be able to share perspectives from Mazon, a Jewish response to hunger, a national organization committed to ending hunger among people of all faiths and backgrounds in the U.S. and Israel. In Jewish tradition and across all faith traditions, there's a fundamental value of taking care of the most vulnerable among us. In Leviticus, we are commanded to leave the corners of our fields and the gleanings of our harvest and vineyards for the poor and the stranger. This commandment is a clear expression of our collective responsibility to each other. Its wisdom respects the dignity of those who are poor and gives them a role in taking care of their needs by harvesting the corners of the fields themselves. We are not to judge those who are poor, nor should we assume to know the circumstances of their lives. In our country today, we are blessed to have a national program that manifests this value and works effectively to provide assistance to those who endure hardship. This program respects the dignity of those who experience hunger and poverty, responds when the needs increase, supports work, promotes long-term health and well-being, contributes to our economy, and provides vital assistance to the most vulnerable in our society. Of course, this program is SNAP. SNAP is not the only assistance that is available, but it is the most essential. The problem of food insecurity is profound and complex, with responses coming both from government programs and from charitable and faith community organizations. While some argue that charity should do more to address food insecurity, the massive scale of this problem and the realities of the charitable sector demonstrate just how unreasonable this is. Many of these agencies are small operations run out of basements or closets in a local house of worship only a few days each week and for a few hours each day. Only the federal government has the capacity to solve an issue of hunger's magnitude, and SNAP plays a pivotal role providing needed assistance to tens of millions of Americans who struggle. Can SNAP be improved? Of course. But cutting the funding and reach of the program is not an improvement, and transforming SNAP into a block grant program threatens its impact and its responsiveness. Nothing speaks louder to the truth of SNAP than the voices of those affected by hunger. Mazon commissioned photojournalist Barbara Grover to collect stories from people who have experienced this painful reality. One consistent refrain heard is that SNAP benefits routinely don't last until the end of the month, forcing families to take desperate measures to make ends meet. Another is how SNAP recipients often purchase cheap and unhealthy foods to fill them up. To address this, Mazon recommends that Congress change the SNAP benefit calculation to the USDA low-cost food plan in order to provide a more appropriate level of assistance and empower food insecure families to better meet their nutritional needs. On ABODs, too many able-bodied adults without dependents have recently found themselves cut off from SNAP benefits after the reimposition of the 3-month time limit. Who are these ABODs? They are 60,000 veterans. They are single parents of children over the age of 18. They are homeless individuals and ex-offenders who struggle to find employment. They are residents of areas where economic recovery has failed to materialize. They are 19-year-olds who have just aged out of foster care and have no family on whom to rely. Reimposing time limits seems cruel and misplaced when too little is being done to ensure that these people have access to good-paying job opportunities and available job training slots. We recommend that innovative and effective employment and training programs be robustly funded, made more widely accessible, and set up with reasonable parameters, including individualized case management. It is critical that these are voluntary programs that build people up, rather than mandatory sanction-based programs that penalize individuals. More needs to be done to connect underserved populations with assistance. High rates of food insecurity among seniors, veterans, Native Americans, college students, and LGBT individuals are concerning, and more must be done to increase SNAP participation for these groups. We recommend additional outreach and education efforts to make individuals in these and other underserved populations aware of the assistance available to them through SNAP and remove the barriers that prevent them from accessing it. Mazon's work reveals that stigma associated with SNAP is a significant barrier to participation. The perpetuation of myths and negative stereotypes of SNAP participants in the media and by public officials is damaging to the program, hurts efforts to expand access to people who are struggling, and makes it more difficult to achieve the larger goal of ending hunger. In conclusion, I would simply and vehemently state that SNAP works. While there are certainly opportunities to make program improvements, including increasing benefit levels and expanding program access, the fundamental structure of SNAP as an entitlement program is solid and should not be undermined. Instead, robust and targeted investments to strengthen program features should be considered. Along with my written testimony, I have shared just a few stories of people impacted by SNAP featured in Mazon's traveling multimedia exhibition, This Is Hunger. I encourage you to read these personal reflections and keep in mind the real people this program helps. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Provost. Ms. Hatcher, go ahead and proceed with your 5 minutes of testimony when you're ready. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify and for the work that each of you has already done to understand SNAP and its importance. First, the supermarket retailers, wholesalers, and suppliers that FMI represents are fortunate to work with some of the world's best farmers and ranchers to ensure that the products we have on the shelf are safe, top quality, available year-round, and at the most affordable price possible. From the food retail perspective, SNAP has evolved in a positive way over the past several years. It has become more efficient, more flexible to address unique needs, and less prone to fraud or error. We now have a national electronic program with nationally approved products that is consistent from state to state. We've seen tremendous operational efficiencies, particularly around fresh product due to the expansion of the dates SNAP benefits are distributed by state agencies to customers. The administrative and licensing function is working extremely well. SNAP has very adeptly addressed significant fluctuation in the number of eligible beneficiaries. A couple of suggestions moving forward. First, there's enormous opportunity for USDA to continue to allow for innovation and flexibility in how we serve the customer, engaging the SNAP customer in a digital format. Second, we continue to continue our focus on the efficiency of the transmission part of the transaction. Third, there should be no mandatory fees charged to merchants. Fourth, we need to encourage new entrants to the EBT contractor space to bring greater efficiency and innovation. Finally, the USDA online pilot needs to include more grocers, more locations as soon as possible to have a greater impact on technology design. There's been a great deal of thoughtful discussion regarding what SNAP participants are buying and how those products contribute to health. FMI's president and CEO, Leslie Saracen, recently testified before the committee about how SNAP restrictions would affect the grocery industry and our customers. Additionally, last May, Kathy Hanna with the Kroger Company testified about a partnership Kroger had entered with AARP, who received a Food Insecurity Nutrition Incentive, or FINNY, grant from USDA. Another example of a successful and growing FINNY partnership is the Double Up Food Bucks program, operating in 17 Family Fare Spartan Nash stores in Michigan and 51 Price Chopper stores in Kansas City, Missouri. An amazing 95% of FMI's supermarket members report employing dietitians at the corporate, regional, and store level. Additionally, a growing number of FMI members are employing in-store chefs. Some have suggested that beyond the incentives, we should look at penalties and restrictions. Thought coming from folks on what these penalties or restrictions might look like are all over the map. Some have proposed that penalties should only apply to certain states or counties. Others have suggested that penalties should only apply to certain people. The efficiencies and simplicity of the administrative function of SNAP have happened because of the consistency of a national program. If we put a pilot or a block grant in place in one store or a series of stores or in one county, it will require significant IT spending. If a penalty were put in place in one county or stores or state, the customer would simply avoid shopping in the location with the restrictions in place, penalizing not only the customer but also the store owners. Many have said that they don't want the penalty to apply to seniors or veterans or the disabled or those with young children. Recent USDA figures indicate that 82% of SNAP benefit dollars are currently utilized by those customers. If this concept was developed into policy, would some kind of indicator be put on the SNAP cards of those individuals for whom penalties would apply? Would store clerks be charged with enforcement of that process? Would a team of people at USDA be hired to develop and update an electronic product list of those items that would trigger a penalty or a restriction and send it electronically to the 260,000 SNAP-authorized retailers on a monthly basis? As you can see, an idea that seems relatively simple in theory could have enormous impact, expense, and complexity without a clear benefit. I'd be pleased to try to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Hatcher. The chair would like to remind members that they will be recognized for questioning in order of seniority from members who were here at the start of the hearing. After that, members will be recognized in order of arrival and appreciate the members' understanding. We're joined in this hearing by the ranking member of the full Agriculture Committee. So I'm pleased to recognize Mr. Peterson for 5 minutes of questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't take 5 minutes, but appreciate you holding this hearing and appreciated the witness's testimony. This hearing is titled The Next Farm Bill, The Future of SNAP. Well, I believe that the future of SNAP is in the Farm Bill. And I think that everybody knows by now that that I doubt if it's not in the Farm Bill, that we won't even have a Farm Bill in the future. I know there are other members of the committee and other members of the House and Senate who agree with that assessment, but I worry that the House leadership isn't on the same page. And I don't want to find us in another situation where leadership steps in and mucks this up by adding unrealistic work requirements or some other ideological policy that would blow up the whole bill, similar to what happened in 2013. The committee's review of SNAP covered a lot of issues. We heard about the success of the program. We also heard some ways that we may be able to improve performance. And I hope that we can keep these facts in mind and find some common ground to make sure SNAP is as effective as policy, effective as possible, and that we maintain this effective program. So again, I'm not quite sure where SNAP policy is headed, but the Farm Bill is where it needs to stay. And I want to thank the chair for the time and yield back the balance of my time.
Gentleman yields back. I'll now take the liberty of 5 minutes of questioning. First of all, just thank you to all five of our witnesses for being here today and the experience you're contributing to a great conversation. This is we don't get to good public policy without good information, and that you're serving a tremendous role here. It's appreciated. Mr. Arthur, we've seen many food banks evolve from simply distributing food to providing more comprehensive anti-hunger programming and social service outreach to their local communities. In your testimony, you speak to both the food distribution and SNAP application assistance services that the Central Pennsylvania Food Bank provides. How do you work to connect families to these and other programs such as SNAP or employment and training that may be able to offer them longer term support and a path towards self-sufficiency? And can you reflect a little bit on how do you work collaboratively with partners and other local organizations in your community to provide case management and other types of supportive services?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll take that in a few parts. First of all, we do direct SNAP outreach now as part of all our overall food assistance services. And just for the subcommittee, in our central Pennsylvania territory, if you add up SNAP and the other federal food assistance programs, WIC, the Emergency Food Assistance Program, all of those, they are about 10 times larger in the amount of food that is distributed in our service territory. 10 to 1. And we distributed almost 50 million pounds of food last year. So give you an idea of the scale here. The second part of that, we do SNAP outreach because we think it is a very efficient way to serve. And as I noted in my written testimony, we're actually on the low end of participation rates for eligible SNAP. Or folks that might be eligible for SNAP in central Pennsylvania, lower than the national average, lower than the state average. So we decided that something needed to be done, that we needed to be in that type of work, and we actually right now support that on just privately funded dollars, no tax dollars. We believe that's a very important way to serve. With respect to other services, we're proud that many of our partners do very holistic services. Right in their communities and their neighborhoods. So community action programs, Salvation Army programs, of course, many faith-based organizations and others that actually do, in addition to food service, do direct assistance with job searches, training, et cetera. We feel that we are a better partner if we can take away all of the food assistance costs and work. And then lend our shoulder to their work to help people get connected to jobs. So while we don't directly create a lot of jobs, although I have 100 employees, we do help others that do that. We believe that's very important. Probably the newest work that we do is with healthcare. We are working with some of the primary healthcare organizations in central Pennsylvania. Names you might know would be like Penn State Hershey Medical would be a big one, Geisinger Health Systems. We work with them at the intersection of healthy eating and good health outcomes. And there are a lot of details in the programs that we do, but it's very important that we do that work as well. And we also, as Chairman Thompson has seen, we actually have teaching kitchens, and we do a very robust curricula around helping our member agencies and their clients learn better habits on the whole food chain. We're very proud of that. And last year we did over 1,600 hours of training like that. So I am very proud that we are part of the broad spectrum of not only making sure people are fed, but that they can sustain their own lives. We are working to end hunger, not just to feed people. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Provost, I mean, you, in your testimony, I appreciate your testimony, you really kind of touched on the diversity of individuals that are within that able-bodied adult without dependence sort of classification or label, I guess, but and time limits and subsequent employment and training programs. What do you see as the key to engaging individuals? How do you do that to the better engage recipients so that you ensure that they are able to reach their full potential and progress in their pathway out of poverty?
Thanks for the question. I think it's important that there are opportunities available to these ABODs in many locations where an individual may be facing a time limit. There simply aren't enough job opportunities or available job training slots. So to have the expectation for somebody to participate in a job training program that isn't there, or to find a job that is not readily available or accessible for them in the community where they live, is an unfair expectation. So investments to make sure that we have job training opportunities that are readily available, that have case management that will effectively help that person along that path and help that person get back to work. We heard in previous hearings testimony from other witnesses about the importance of that individualized case management, and I think that's just a critical component that more investment is needed in.
Thank you. My time has expired. Please recognize the ranking member for 5 minutes of questioning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to applaud the opening statement of our ranking member, Mr. Peterson. And I think, as you can tell, some of us are just a little anxious about where we might be going as we approach the Farm Bill with regard to SNAP. And part of it is because of some statements that we've seen in the press about additional requirements and potential changes that make us a little bit uneasy. But I think we need to be, you know, clear-eyed as we move forward to make sure that whatever we're contemplating on doing, that it's actually the right thing and it's based on reality and not based on perception. Because I think some of the perception with regard to people who are on SNAP is not reflective of real life. There are many people on this program who work and they earn so little that they still qualify for the benefit. We had 20 hearings and this is the 20th the majority actually put together a report without any input from the minority. So I'd like to ask unanimous consent to insert into the record a letter I sent to Chairman Conway, kind of giving my side of the story on these 19 hearings.
Without objection.
The latest target seems to be these able-bodied adults with a dependence. I think it's a very complicated population. Ms. Dean, in your recommendations, you acknowledge that increasing the current SNAP, in your testimony, you expressed concern about the loss of benefits for vulnerable ABOD populations. Can you identify for us what some of the challenges might be for people who can't meet the work requirements to avoid the current 3-month time limit? And what do you think about suggestions that the waiver should be completely eliminated or that we should reduce the amount of time ABODs can spend on SNAP?
I think that's a very ill-advised policy approach. To withdraw more food assistance from this desperately poor group, I don't think is going to improve their well-being or the well-being of the communities that they live in. I think one of the mistakes we make about this group is think that they are some kind of unified demographic solely by the fact of their age, 18 right. through 49, and they're without children. And they're not working 20 hours a week. That's how the law groups them together, but of course, in life, they are different kinds of people. I think Mr. Protas's testimony pulled out some terrific examples of folks who could struggle. An 18-year-old who just ages out of foster care with no family support system may not have. There's no more state support to help this individual find work. An ex-offender, someone who's just left prison, is probably hopefully getting help for job training. But the reality is, the job market for ex-offenders is just not the same as everyone else. And then also, the group overall tends to be working in very low-wage, low-skill jobs that have a higher unemployment rate than the overall unemployment rate. And so our expectation that they, when they lose a job, or again, fall below 20 hours a week, so working 18 hours a week is not enough. If they lose a couple of shifts, it may take them more than what's left on their 90-day clock to raise those hours again. Yes. So there are a lot of reasons right. why they struggle.
And Mr. Protas, I appreciated your comments about ABODs, and I'm concerned about this population, and I'm concerned about how we characterize them here, you know, in Congress. Oftentimes they're characterized as people who just don't want to work, or they're lazy, or you know, they're trying to take advantage of the system. When my experience, from what I've been able to tell, is again that's not an accurate picture, and I'd be concerned to. I'd like to hear your response to how do the characterizations of ABODs distract from our goal of ending hunger, and how can these critical depictions discourage underserved populations like veterans from getting the help that they so desperately need?
Thank you for the question. We regularly encounter instances where misinformation and negative associations about SNAP make those who are struggling reluctant to seek out help, including, as you said, seniors, veterans, and surprisingly currently serving military families. And I want to just express thanks to Chairman Thompson and to you, Ranking Member McGovern, for your support of the Military Hunger Prevention Act. In our work with military families, we know that many of them are very reluctant to come for help and to apply for SNAP because of the negative associations with the program. And that comes from public discussions, from things that are out there in the media. And when people are struggling and need that help and are reluctant to participate in a program and to apply for a program, it hurts. It hurts their families, it hurts the kids in those families. And so this negative rhetoric has real consequences, and it really needs to stop.
Thank you. I guess I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank the gentleman. Now please recognize the gentleman from Arkansas, Mr. Crawford, for 5 minutes of questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you all for being here today. Ms. Hatcher, I want to start with some technology issues. Since the program's inception, we know that technology has moved at an exponential pace, and some of the changes that have taken place have moved us more to an electronic-based type of administration of the program. What are some of the challenges that you see that retailers have to manage with regard to maintaining pace with that technology, and how does that affect ultimately the beneficiaries?
I mean, I think we've certainly benefited by moving the program finally to 100% electronic. You know, in the days where you were talking with paper coupons and there was a lot more opportunity for fraud, what we're looking at now is taking the next step and using some of the digital and online resources to be able to offer those to SNAP customers as well. I know that USDA has put in place a pilot project for 7 states and 7 stores. But I guess what I'm saying is I think we can go beyond that. You know, so many things are moving to online, and you know, we need to really get in at the ground level on this to make sure that we're moving the technology along with SNAP in the right direction.
Do you think the agency is keeping pace with regard to that technology? Are there some barriers between the retailer and the administrators, or are we staying in close contact, or are we having some challenges there?
I definitely think we're staying in close contact. There are certainly additional opportunities, and we want to make sure that we're not doing something that's going to move us in the wrong direction. One of the things we're trying to do is to encourage more EBT contractors to enter the space, because with more competition and more contractors, you get more ideas and more innovation. We just had one recent addition that I think folks are pretty excited about to add to the folks that are out there. So I think that's one of the things that we want to help to do, is to get that information out to other businesses that might be interested in entering this environment to move down with additional ideas.
One of the topics that comes up invariably, we talk about food deserts and we're talking about nutrition programs and things of that nature. And ironically, this was a topic that we had earlier in a hearing today, is one of the most productive rural or agricultural districts in the country, mine, and we have problems with access to healthy mm-hmm. food. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about in previous hearings, we've talked about possibly grocery stores serving as essentially distributors going out into rural areas that are relying on convenience stores almost exclusively for their nutrition. Can you talk about what a good model might be to help incentivize grocers to sort of act as those distributors to small rural communities that don't otherwise have access to healthy food? Because healthy food choices are also a part of the problem, in when all you have is access to prepared foods that aren't maybe necessarily the greatest in health benefit.
No, I think that's a great point. We're starting to see a lot of innovation in that space, where in a community where it may not make sense to build a freestanding grocery store in a particular area, we've seen more mobile vans utilizing libraries and other community centers, as well as like you mentioned, convenience stores, more delivery models where there may be, where you could deliver some of those products rather than having a freestanding store there. So I think there are a lot of potential opportunities going forward, but the vans has probably had a lot of promise, where you have a store that has a van that's going in a particular area or distributing to another location.
I'm sure technology enhances that or facilitates that to a large degree. Are you aware of any kind of tax incentives that can be utilized to incentivize a retailer to participate in that space?
I'm not aware of any tax incentives right now on that, but certainly we'll look into it and see if there's anything anybody's tapped into, because that might be it might be a really good opportunity.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yield back.
Gentleman yields back. Please recognize the lady from North Carolina, Ms. Adams, for 5 minutes of questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ranking Member McGovern. Thank you. Thank you to the witnesses for your testimony. In the 12th District of North Carolina that I represent, there are some parts of Charlotte that are enjoying economic growth with real estate prices that rival those here in Washington, D.C. However, many neighborhoods throughout the city have not been able to participate in the new economic opportunities that exist just a few miles down the road. Whole communities have been left behind by how Charlotte has grown over the last several decades. And so as the city works to bring more equitable development and opportunities to everyone in the city, we need the SNAP program more than ever to help families put food on the table from 1 month to the next. Ms. Dean, last year, the state of North Carolina decided to stop all waivers for SNAP work requirements for able-bodied adults. Can you spell out how imposing SNAP work requirements on able-bodied adults risk states kicking people off the program who are still eligible to participate?
Thank you for that question. Yeah, it was the state legislature, I think, prohibited the governor from ever seeking a waiver again in the future, which struck me as really short-sighted with respect to policy, particularly in a state, for example, that experiences so many hurricanes as natural disasters. Wanting the ability to respond to individuals, it seems to me you'd want that flexibility. The North Carolina Budget and Tax Policy Center did a terrific analysis of the state's decision to cut off all waivers and therefore impose the time limit. And they actually looked at some of the rural counties in North Carolina and compared the number of available jobs to the number of individuals who are going to be cut off. And the number being cut off because they weren't working 20 hours a week exceeded the number of available jobs collected by the governor. And of course, available jobs doesn't mean jobs that these individuals are qualified for. So it is shifting an enormous burden to the charitable sector to step in and help feed these individuals. And I think it undermines their ability to work when they spend most of their time looking for how to feed themselves. Yeah. So it was a very unfortunate decision.
Yes, thank you very much. I served 20 years in the North Carolina House, and we have made the best decisions all the time.
Congresswoman Adams, I wanted to call out to Congressman Evans's work with one of our members in Philadelphia on this issue with ex-offenders and finding jobs for them through Uplift Solutions. So I think there are some private public-private partnerships in his that can be impactful.
Thank you very much. As a follow-up, Ms. Dean, we have discussed in previous hearings that many states do not offer a standard medical expense deduction for seniors and the disabled to document their true cost of living when they apply or recertify for SNAP benefits. And states that do offer standard medical deductions, have you seen more seniors claiming the deduction in order to increase their monthly SNAP benefits?
We have, and I think your bill on that is offers a terrific policy idea to make it easier for states to offer the medical expense deduction, which basically targets more food assistance to seniors and people with disabilities with significant out-of-pocket medical expenses. Mm-hmm. It's an underutilized feature of the program and sets up a dynamic between paying for drugs and other health needs and food. SNAP has a feature to help seniors and people with disabilities, and we want to see more states take advantage of it.
Okay. You've documented through the organization that these benefits have consistently not kept pace with rising food costs. So how would switching to the low-cost food plan permit SNAP recipients to more adequately put food on the table?
Well, the low-cost food plan is about 30% higher than the USDA's estimate of a thrifty food plan. So it would provide additional food benefits. Just to be clear, SNAP benefits do keep pace with food inflation, but what they haven't done is what USDA hasn't been able to do is reevaluate the Thrifty Food Plan in light of our changing understanding of what makes a healthy diet. So access to fresh produce, shifting away extreme assumptions about SNAP households purchasing, getting their protein from milk and dried beans as opposed to chicken and cheese. It's just out of sync with what we're all buying and what is what the cost of a basic healthy diet.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair. I'm out of time.
Thanks to the gentlelady. Now please recognize the gentleman from Kansas, Mr. Marshall, for 5 minutes of questioning.
Thank you so much. I think my first question is for Mr. Sykes. I'm always interested in efficiency. Whenever I'm responsible for other people's money, I try to take even better care of it. So talk a little bit about efficiency. I think I read somewhere 93% is a number. Has that been a pretty good number the past 20 years, or where have we been up and down?
I presume you're talking about payment accuracy at this point.
No, efficiency.
The share that goes to.
If we give you a dollar, how much of it is actually being spent on food by the person?
Well, I think virtually all of it is being spent on food by the person because other than small limitations on what could be purchased, the interesting thing is we reach over 83% of eligible households, which is an extraordinarily high percentage of eligibles. And even more importantly, that about 90-plus percent of all possible benefits are being issued, which means that some people that may be left out of the program.
No, I guess that's a different efficiency. The efficiency I'm wondering is if we're given a dollar to the SNAP program, how much of that's being spent on food?
93%. You got it right. The rest is on admin and programs like employment insurance.
And what's that been like the past 20 years? Is that a good number?
Yeah, I think it's eked up just a bit, but that's about the level. It's been around 93-95% for a while.
Okay. I get my next question, I think, for Ms. Dean. Ms. Dean, I'm an obstetrician. WIC has been a very, very successful program for my patients, moms, pregnant moms and breastfeeding moms. And the great thing about WIC, when my patients touch those people, the whole family touches them, and they're in the same building where maybe that they get flu shots and other public health care needs. Explain to me how WIC works with SNAP and opportunities for working with each other.
So I love the WIC program too. I think it is an incredible evidence-based program that hits infants and toddlers right at the moment that they most need it. WIC is a prescription benefit, though, that it provides supplemental foods. It assumes that the household is also getting SNAP or has enough income to be able to buy a basic diet. So, whereas SNAP is available to purchase any or all foods, WIC is prescription and limited. So that's a big difference. I do think, and I really hope that the committee takes a look at ensuring that all SNAP households with a pregnant or postpartum mom, infants and toddlers, also take advantage of WIC. That's pretty true for infants, but it's not true for toddlers through the age of 4. And I think that would be an enormous and important benefit boost at that critical stage of life. And even just measuring and ranking states could improve performance there.
Okay. I yield back.
The gentleman yields back. At 302, votes have been called on the House floor. So I apologize. The committee will stand in recess until they've been concluded. I encourage all members to return promptly so that we can reconvene at that time after the conclusion of votes.